Hey guys, and welcome back to Classic Camera Revival. I am Alex Lokes, and this month we are celebrating Kodak. Yes, that's right. It's July, and the reason why we've put our Kodak show here in July is because the 12th of July is celebrated as International Kodak Day, because that was George Eastman's birthday. George Eastman, of course, being the gentleman who started Kodak and really helped bring photography to the masses. It was through his efforts and his innovations and his outright monopoly of the photography industry of the late 19th and throughout the early to mid 20th century that allowed us to really be here today, right? You have him bringing about the dry plate and flexible film and the Kodak Brownie, and I could go on and on and on and on and on, but enough with that. Let's get this show started.
Coming to you live from Toronto, Canada, this is the Classic Camera Revival. If you don't have gear acquisition syndrome now, you certainly will after listening to our show.
Hey guys, we're back. Okay, so we have quite a variety on the show today. So we're going to get it started with some stuff here locally. So we're going to start with Mike talking about one of the most prestigious 35mm cameras to come out of Kodak in the mid-20th century.
Yep, the Kodak Signet 35. The way I always look at it is it's the best red dot camera you can buy. So yeah, 35mm Ektar lens, plus the way they designed it with the 46mm focal length was for the best coverage of the film, because something to do with the size of the film and yada yada, whatever. It basically, it shoots like rainbows and puppies and all that fun stuff. But no, down to the basics on it, it is really compact, really simple to use. Now, it was designed for, say, like GIs in the field, which is the great thing for a lot of Canadian weather, because we don't have really that best of a summer. It's kind of short. And so one of the things I like about it is the fact that you can use gloves with it. It's got big knobs. That sounds terrible. Okay, it's got big dials on it. It's got a really big shutter release on it. And it's really, really simple to use. Plus the fact that it has a single rangefinder on it, as opposed to having the viewfinder, rangefinder separate, which is really nice. And I find it's really, really, really easy to use. Now, it's not all fun and games with this camera, unfortunately. I will have to say a couple bad things about it, although it is my favorite red dot camera. It always will be my favorite red dot camera. The rangefinder on it, very common for it to lose contrast, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that's really unfortunate about it is the shutter. Why they put one of the fiddliest, finickiest, worst speed shutters I will never understand on such a high-end camera. I mean, this thing is amazing until you get to the shutter. It doesn't really have much option to it. You've got like four shutter speeds and that's it. And I mean, my zone focus viewfinder cameras have four shutter speeds, but they just don't have the rangefinder. So it's kind of unfortunate that they did that route. Mm. It's kind of sad, but maybe it was to bring down cost. I'm not 100% sure, but at the same time, I mean, their retina line was, they had fantastic Copal shutters in them. I mean, you had everything from 1 second all the way up to 500s. Why didn't they do that with a Signet? Come on, guys. But too little too late now. But aside from that, cost wise they're fantastic. You can find them on eBay. A lot of time the focus is a little stiff, a little bit of gun oil in the bearings will actually bring that right back to life, which is another thing that's really nice, is the focus is all done through ball bearings.
Nice.
Which they actually learned that lesson from the Medalist with the double helicoid that they had with that, but they went to ball bearings, which is amazing. And it also kept it going in cold weather, which was the big thing, is
right.
With Canadian cold weather and even upper northwest cold weather in the U.S., it would get fairly chilly. And the fact that you can use it with gloves on, you're outside in the winter shooting with this camera. And there's a reason why it actually did fairly well off the shelves. So,
plus, it looks fantastic. It's a really well-designed camera. It has good shelf value as well.
Yeah, well, it's like milled out of just a solid chunk of aluminum. I mean, how much better can you look? And the great thing about aluminum is as it ages, it almost looks like it went through the war.
It has a nice patina to it. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I really love this camera. It's so much fun to use. And the other part on it that I'm not going to get into, but I'm going to have a little bit of blurb on it on our show notes, is on the back of the camera, I love that little the film meter that they've got.
That's right, the sliders.
Yeah, the Sunny 16 built on the camera.
Nice. So we're going from one high-end camera to another high-end camera, but the difference is that whereas the Signet 35 was built here in North America, in Rochester, John's Retina is a German-built Kodak camera. So take it away, John.
Yep. Thanks, Alex. I'm talking today about the Retina or Retina. I've heard both. So
I think it probably can go with both. It's not an iPhone.
Yeah. Retina.
Whatever rocks your boat.
My Retina.
This is a Retina 2A. It dates from the early 1950s. I think it's sort of roughly in the middle of the the Retina was a very long lifespan series of cameras, and I think at this point, this is where they really started to hit the sweet spot with this camera. It's beautiful. Everything about it says German high quality precision. Beautiful lens. I've got the Xenon 2.0 f/2, so fairly fast lens on it. It's a little clamshell, so it's not quite shirt pocket unless you have like steel reinforced shirts, but it will go in a bag or a backpack, and it's fairly tough. This has a reputation for being an excellent picture taker from a quality point of view, and I'd have to agree. As a user, it does take a bit of getting used to. I think ergonomically, to my mind, there are some challenges with it, like holding it open and getting, you know, my thumb doesn't automatically go to the focus knob.
No.
And the viewfinder, and let's face it, this was a common malady of cameras from the 50s, is that it's a, air quotes, squinty viewfinder. There are no bright line in it. There's no parallax adjustment. It is sort of squinty, and in mine, the rangefinder patch is not particularly contrasty, so it can be a bit of a trick to focus. Plus, I think the rangefinder needs a bit of calibration on my side or on its in order to be fully usable. Now, one thing about this camera in terms of they're fairly plentiful. The 2A is one of the cheaper models online. The 3Cs tend to be the more expensive ones, and if you go with the really old ones, tend not to have the rangefinders. And at the end of the Retina model lifespan, Kodak was churning out some crap. The Retina Reflex, stay away from it, bad reputation. There's a Retina 126, same thing. The 2s and the 3s, I think, are the ones to look at. One thing that is an issue with the 2s is they upgraded the film wind mechanism. So it works quite nicely. However, there are a couple of parts in here that are very, very susceptible to just snapping, to breaking. And then you have to get them repaired. So if you get this camera, like when it's closed and you're carrying it around, it's fine. You don't have to baby it per se. But when you're shooting it, treat it like a precision mechanism. Like this is probably not the camera to go camping with, particularly when winding the film. Like don't... Sorry, that there should have been a visual to go with that sound.
Yeah, that wasn't like, John like, farting.
Yeah, thank you. Everything about this camera means like treat it with respect and use a light hand on it, particularly the film wind, because once it's broken, it's broken. There is, I forget the guy's name, but I think we mentioned before that all these old brands, there's always sort of one guy.
Retina Rescue.
Retina Rescue. Thank you. He's the guy's in New Zealand, and his rates are quite reasonable. So if you need work done, or just a CLA, or a range finder calibration, he's the guy to send it to. Just to finish up, this camera has a sterling reputation, well-deserved. I think it belongs in any collector's shelf.
Fantastic. Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Or a camera bag for actual taking pictures.
Yes.
Yeah, just remember that when you're closing it up, you got to put it down to infinity. Otherwise, it won't close.
There you go.
And also, another quick note on Retina Rescue. The really nice thing is he actually has some step-by-steps online on how to do a rangefinder culmination on the retinas or retina cameras, which I think is pretty good to have.
Cool. Fantastic.
If you're inclined to do that kind of repair.
Yeah. Now, we're actually quite lucky because we have on the host team a former Kodak employee.
How nice red she's going. You'd figure it'd be yellow considering.
Yes. So, Donna, as a former Kodak employee, what was it like to work for Kodak and what did you do for them?
Working for Kodak was probably one of the best jobs that I've ever had. Kodak was just, the employees there were amazing to work with. I've never had, out of all the companies I've worked for, usually someone's always complaining about their job. And in Kodak, I'm being honest, everybody there was happy. They never complained. They all seemed to like their job. They all got along. It was the best. The bosses were the best. I have no complaints about working in Kodak. When I first started there, I got in through a friend of mine. Her grandma worked there, and that's how I got into Kodak. When I first started, I was packing boxes. Actually, I made boxes for all the photo paper to go into. And every time I kept walking around when I was done and asking questions about all the photos and about all the film and black and white photo paper. And, you know, I just kept going around trying to get familiar with everything. And one day, I can't remember the guy's name for the life of me, but he was like, how would you like it to come into the dark room and help us pack black and white photo paper? And I was like, I would love to do that. So he goes, okay, you'll start tomorrow. So next day I went in, I did shift work. So next day when I went in early morning, put us in a dark room, you're under the red light and you have a certain amount of time. You've got a stack load of black bags. You have a certain amount of time to pack as much of this photo paper in, and the stacks are already piled up for you. And we did hundreds and hundreds by the end of the day. And it was amazing. I'm really sad that it is no longer here anymore. But if it was still here, I would never have left.
No, it makes sense. And by here, she means the former Kodak plant in Toronto, which is demolished save for the one historical building, Building 9, which unfortunately is in pretty rough shape. I had a chance to sneak into it. Sadly, only once. I saw the entire plant just after it closed before the demolition. My purpose was, of course, to try and get in there, but I was caught by security before hopping the fence, so I didn't get in trouble for doing this. We'll make sure to include some photos from, because
I've been actually a couple times. I've got one absolutely gorgeous photo, and every time I see it, it's pretty emotional for me, because every time I see it, it's the front staircase, and I've actually seen the front staircase when it was in its...
Kodak was a beautiful building when it had everything in it on your lunch break. It had movie theaters. It was just...
Mm-hmm. And I've actually been into their gymnasium that's there. Yeah. And it was unreal. The stuff in Kodak number 9, it's just a beautiful building. And the big historical significance to this building is this was their Kodachrome processing unit. I mean, if you went into the basement
here in Canada,
they had the big rollers in there. And I was informed from Donna that there's a couple times where she was actually on that machine, that very Kodachrome line. There she was.
Yep. So
did you have a job at one point that involved working in total darkness?
Yes. Yeah. There was a few times that you couldn't have any red light at all. It was quite an experience, actually. At first, it takes you quite a little bit of time to get used to being in the pitch black because your eyes just don't. But once don't get me started on the hauntings of that building. There was a haunting on the very top floor. I remember very, very well, actually. When I first started, I had to go pick up paper, and the elevators were old. So just going up in the elevator alone was scary. Mm-hmm. And when you got up there, there was, they kept telling me that there was like a woman that was up there, and they would hear her voice every time that they would go up. And when I went up, I don't know if they were joking with me or not, but you did hear things moving, and I was the only one that was up there to my knowledge. So I forget about the paper and I run back downstairs, but
somebody else go get it.
Yeah, I'm not doing it. But no, I would totally work there again in a heartbeat.
Nice.
I remember coming home from, like, whenever we traveled, I remember coming home on the Highway 401, and when we're coming across, and sure enough, we'd see all the lights of the trucks coming in and going from Kodak Heights. And
yeah.
And I remember in its heyday, it was basically a city within the city. It was just, it was such a beautiful place to see. Mm-hmm.
I think I still have my Kodak entry card to get in and out of the building too.
Oh, that's
so
cool.
If I find it, I'll post up a picture.
Now that's a collectible I'm sure a lot of film shooters would kill to have.
Yeah. Now, the whole idea of Kodak being a huge complex is very, very true. I've seen a lot of the buildings in Rochester. Mm-hmm. And if we thought that the Toronto plant was huge, half of Rochester is Kodak.
Really?
Plus, it's where the gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous Kodak Tower is. And there'll be a photo of it on the episode notes, of course. So we are going to actually hop over to Rochester now, and we're going to be joined by my friend Andrew Hiltz, and we're going to talk about his Kodak camera, the Pony Primo 12, and we're going to go and visit the George Eastman House, which is a gorgeous museum and just this bastion of preservation of photography and motion pictures. Alex Lokes here, Classic Camera Revival, and I have just gotten into the George Eastman House Museum. Now, if you've ever visited the George Eastman House, you know that it is more than just a museum about George Eastman, the man behind Eastman Kodak. It is a museum of photography, the love of photography, the preservation of photography. And I'm just here, just bought my tag, and inside a small room that has some absolutely stunning examples of past cameras. You'll see a few in the episode notes, but it's just absolutely incredible to see the progression of camera technology from massive bellows-based cameras to small Graflex SLRs that take 4x5 to 35mm and medium format equipment here. It's just absolutely incredible. And this is only scratching the surface of the collection that the Eastman House has down in their vaults. Also along the walls are some beautiful images from some of the best known photographers that the world has seen. I'll be back with a bit more later. One of the other fantastic aspects of the George Eastman House is the exhibitions here. And right now I'm looking at some massive silver gelatin prints by Lorna Bieber, not to be confused with the unfortunate Justin Bieber that we have from Canada. But this is pure artistry, and I thought that handling 11 by 14 darkroom prints was difficult. I mean, these things are a good 3 feet by 6 feet. I'd need to build an entire house or a shed to be able to print something this size. And even though the quality looks incredibly rough, the artistry is just fantastic. I'm still in the Lorna Bieber exhibit and standing here in front of probably the centerpiece of the entire exhibit. It is a modern take on a medieval tapestry and is just an absolutely fantastic blend of solargram, photogram, silver gelatin print that fills an entire wall as almost a collage of these. A little bit abstract, not exactly my taste. I can appreciate the artistry that went into the creation of this. One of the things that is impressive about this year is that it is the anniversary of the Technicolor process. It's more motion picture, but I'm standing here in the entrance hall and it's just this huge wall display of sample dyes that was used for the Technicolor process between 1929 and 1975. It's like any museum, especially one related to photography. It's like I'm looking at stuff that is directly related to my hobby and its development as a hobby. And that's really what makes Eastman House special to me, is because if it wasn't for George Eastman and his desire to bring photography to the masses, this podcast wouldn't even exist. So this is truly where Classic Camera Revival began, because of one man who wanted to make this hobby of his accessible to all. Now, the George Eastman House just isn't a museum, and the house itself, there are some gorgeous gardens that are, well, I'm here in May, the show won't air until July, but the gardens are just starting to come back in bloom, so even if you aren't interested in photography, there is certainly something for everyone here, including the Green Thumb. So, yeah, for all you people in Toronto, it is not that far away to come visit, even if it is just to see the gardens. Plus, Rochester is actually a decent town to visit. Okay, we're finally inside the main house itself. Now, Eastman, like he was innovative towards photography, that is reflected clearly in his house for the fact that it had electricity, one of the first houses to have electricity, an internal phone system, an elevator, and one of the key features of it is the fact that every single room was fireproof from every other one. So the doorways are thick. The doors are steel reinforced. It's just absolutely fantastic the amount of work that he put into this house. In fact, he even cut the house in half to expand it, severing all the connections, and was able to easily put it back together. Now, one of the other neat features of this main hall, other than the giant elephant head, is the organ. The organ was recently restored and is actually working, and I've never heard it play, but I'll make sure to find some sort of video of it and put it in the episode notes just for you to hear the sound, because the atrium we're in is designed as an acoustic chamber so that the organ fills the entire house. And as a museum, the staff here have done an absolutely fantastic job restoring and preserving and making it look like this was a lived-in residence, right down to packages of Lucky Strike cigarettes on the table. A few other neat features of this house is the fact that the servants didn't have to lug vacuum cleaners all through it to keep it clean. There was a central vac system. There was also full climate control installed as well. This was all brand new stuff that the world hasn't seen before, and Eastman put this all into his residence. And I mean, the place is gorgeous. It is just absolutely fantastic to see. And the fact he hated to back out of his spot, so his garage had a turntable. Like, he would pull the car in, then it could spin around just like a train. I mean, the man had money in spades, but the fact that he was, you really have to see this house to believe it. Now, the second floor of the house was really where the family had their living quarters, but since the family doesn't actually live here anymore, they have a great display that shows the evolution of photography from the camera obscura, which is simply a darkened room with a pinhole that projects an image, to the Kodak. Now, the name Kodak is synonymous with the company these days, but originally it was a camera, the Kodak camera. Eastman picked the name because there was nothing else named Kodak, and he really liked the letter K. And it's memorable. I mean, everyone, I say Kodak and you think photography. So these cameras that were produced in the late 19th century, 1888, would hold selection of images. You would shoot them all, and then you'd send them back here to Rochester, where they would be developed and printed, and then reloaded with another set of images. Now, this was, of course, predating the roll film cameras, which came into the 20th century. But what was really unique about the original Kodak camera was that the images came out round. Now, you're thinking, that's kind of weird, but you take a look at some of the film that Impossible Project is producing today, and they have gone back to that round format. Personally, I think it would be an interesting process to successfully compose good images using the round format, just like it is for a square format image. And it definitely makes you think. Now, as you heard in our May episode, one of the earliest processes for photography was wet plate. That it can still be used today. There was daguerreotypes beforehand, but wet plate truly brought photography to the masses. Now, the trouble is with wet plate is that it's A, lots of dangerous chemicals, and B, you need to drag a whole bunch of stuff into the field to be able to do that. So one of the first innovations that Eastman brought to the photography world was the dry plate. That was being able to produce images and not have to develop them right away and not have to handle chemistry. It's all here on a plate, ready to go. So again, it just shows that Eastman, who originally started off his career as a bank clerk, really got interested in photography and wanted to make this a little more available to people. Now, one of the really great things that, for me, makes the mark of a really good museum is the fact that a lot of the artifacts you can find here are original to the house. So you have the beds that George Eastman's mother slept in when she lived here before her death. And just, it really ties everything together because you really get to know the family as a whole through looking at the everyday items they used. And it's great that these were nicely preserved and can now be viewed by those interested in the history of the family. Now, the unfortunate fact is the story of George Eastman does not have a happy ending. The man had serious health issues, and one day he just decided to take his own life and left a simple suicide note, which a facsimile is on display right now in the museum, that just says, "To my friends, my work is done. Why wait?" And then he shot himself on the 14th of March, 1932, at age 77. There's no real semblance of where his ashes went. Some were said to have been buried nearby at a Catholic cemetery after he had been declared temporarily insane to allow for him to be buried at a Catholic cemetery. Some of the ashes were scattered, and some still remain today at Kodak Park here in Rochester. So that about wraps up the tour here of the George Eastman House. We'll make sure that there's a link in the show notes on hours and how to visit. And, of course, I'm going to make a stop at the gift shop to peruse what they have here. This is Alex Lux signing off from Rochester, New York. Hey there, guys. Alex Lux here, and I am in the home of the Eastman Kodak Corporation, probably one of the most influential photography companies of the 20th century. And I'm sitting here with a very good friend of mine and fellow film photographer, Andrew Hiltz. And we'd like to talk to you about a couple of innovations that Kodak made, the first of which being their lenses, specifically the luminization coating that was developed in the... When did they start doing that, Andrew?
It was right around the middle of World War II, actually. So you're looking early 40s on this, and that's a pretty early process for coating these lenses. So a lot of companies were actually coating lenses prior to this, and they had, you know, a lot of what you hear is the traditional, like, fluorine coatings and stuff like that. And those were some of the early coatings for some of the other lenses that just gave it better transmission properties. And more than anything else, honestly, let most companies during wartime use cheaper glass so that way they could still get reasonably the same result with crap glass instead of good stuff like they were using before. So one of the things that Kodak kind of did out of this, and this is one of the interesting things I've found from my research, is Kodak started using the luminization process first with its Ektar glasses. And so most of the Ektar lenses that you would find are generally on higher-end cameras. Ektar was their original formula, and many of you guys are going to know Ektar from the new film, but Ektar was originally a lens mark to signify that this is some of the best glass that we can make. So these are often, rather than standard crown glass, like a lot of the better lenses you'd find at the time, like even many of like the top-end Schneiders, like when you look at the Xenons and the Xenars, despite them being some very, very fine glass, were made out of traditional crown glass, which is some of the best, but still reasonably affordable. Kodak was finding some of the more exotic, I suppose you could say, ways to make their glass and actually really building a lot of their lenses to as high of a spec as they could under that Ektar name. And in many of these cases, these Ektar lenses were getting coated through the luminization process. So for those of you following along at home, many of you know that a lot of lenses are slightly radioactive due to being coated with thorium isotopes. And you'll catch certain lenses having these, you know, some of the famous ones are a lot of the older Tacumar screw mount lenses that you'll find for older Pentax bodies. And those were coated, and you'll usually notice those because they kind of start turning yellowy brown. The Kodak lenses, many of which, again, were Ektar lenses, were coated and they were luminized. That was their process for it. Coated inside and out in most cases, and you'll catch those with a little L and a circle on the lens. So on the very front of the front element, usually we'll catch a little L and a circle, usually white, sometimes it's red, and those lenses are marked as luminized. So again, it's a way for them to be able to take some of this, particularly, you know, in the early days, some of the crappier glass, and be able to get those better image quality out of it. But when you run into something like an Ektar that's been luminized, that's actually something that was in the early days of color correction to be able to get the best color onto generally early slide films that you'd be able to get. So some of those transmission properties would really cut down on things like chromatic aberrations and color fringing and really help out with areas of transition, especially from like highlights to low lights, higher contrast areas, to be able to make those areas more optically I mean, technically correct, but also more appealing to the end user, especially when they were making prints. Resolving power on a lot of these lenses is surprisingly good. I've used Ektar lenses. I have two sitting here in front of us right now, one for a 4x5, which Alex is the only person who shot. This 4x5 has on the front of it an Ektar, let's see, it's 127mm 4.7, which is a very nice lens, and Alex has some pretty nice photos out of it. Unfortunately, the bellows on this camera are spotty, so his photos that came out of this tend to look a little kind of stripey because of the pattern from the holes in the bellows. But that being said, you can tell that the lens certainly held up its fair share of the work on making those images. I also have sitting in front of us a Retina that I got. This is an oddball, too, because it's a Retina 2.
But what makes this one different from the one that John has talked about is that this one actually has an Ektar lens on it instead of a Schneider lens.
In some rare cases, a Rodenstock. So some of them had a Rodenstock Heliogon. Most of them had a Schneider Xenon, I want to say. But this one made it out of Germany with the Kodak Ektar, which was really intended to be a competitor for Leica and Contax in the German market, because they were, discerning consumers of fine photographic equipment. And so they really made, you know, Kodak wanted to put their name on this, and they brought that Retina to the game. And this is a 47mm F2, which I've shot a few times. I did have a slight light leak in the bellow the first time I shot it, which actually turned out to make some very interesting results for color film that made it look like it was, in fact, shot back in the 40s. So I took it out to downtown Rochester and got some great images that looked like they were much older than they actually were. After I fixed the bellows on that, though, I tended to shoot a little bit more with black and white on this one. And resolving is really just outstanding on this. Even with Tri-X, so I've Tri-X my trusty film, and shooting with that, you know, it easily out-resolves the grain in the film. And you can tell that there's a lot more for this lens to give. You know, I've looked at it with some other films, and certainly has a lot of power there. And it's a nice, light little lens. I don't shoot the camera as often as I should because it's horribly slow. Everything fully manual, including cocking the shutter every single time after you take a shot, before your next shot. So it doesn't even have a stroke rewind lever either. So I'm stuck with the thumb screws, and it's just very slow to use. But it's a delight once I actually process those images. So aluminized lenses also made their way later through the end of the 50s and early 60s into some of the cheap cameras. So a couple of the cool things that Kodak was doing was for them to be able to cut down on cost, they would start using either very cheap glass lenses, so usually like a simple meniscus lens, or occasionally like a doublet. So if you're looking at things like some of the Hawkeyes, for example, or I had one of my friends right now has my Brownie Hawkeye Target. Yes, Brownie Hawkeye Target, a 620 camera that has a plastic outer lens, single simple meniscus glass middle lens that's luminized. And it's a very cheap camera overall. I bought it at a flea market for $5, and I don't think they were much more than $5 back in the day when they were manufactured. Granted, you know, more money in today's dollars, but really sharp lens considering its very, very simple construction. And it's just one of those things that Kodak did to you know, really put it in the favor of the consumer to provide that best image quality possible, even with some of the cheaper materials that they were using to sell a lower price point camera.
Mm. Now, we mentioned earlier about this Kodak Pony Primo number 6. Now, this is probably the oldest camera that we've ever featured on this show because it comes from 1912. As Andrew mentioned, I'm the only one who's actually shot it, and I actually kind of liked it. Very simple to use. Reminds me a lot of working with a Crown and a Speed Graphic, simply because everything folds up into a box. You don't have to reattach the front standard and all that. Now, he did mention about the bellows. These bellows are in pretty rough shape, but it is a over 100-year-old camera.
Original bellows. Sealskin.
Oh.
Original sealskin bellows.
How very Canadian.
Yeah, nice camera. I love looking at it. I wish I had time and patience and resources to use it. And maybe next time Alex comes down, I will take him up on the offer to shoot. I just have a horrible backlog of negatives that I have not yet even processed. So I didn't take him up on it this time. But certainly it's a neat little camera. And throwing a lens like this onto something modern certainly provides a lot different of a look that some people really seem to enjoy. You know, throwing something on this onto a modern body that would be able to have, you know, more movements for you and certainly better shaped bellows could really give some interesting results, you know. And when looking at some of these, it definitely has a lot of resolving power for black and white especially. So this is something you could easily run, you know, T-Max 100 through and get every bit as much detail as T-Max can handle, even in a large format like 4x5. You know, one of the neat things about these is they really were kind of optimized for those early slide films. So when you're looking at something like, you know, older Kodachrome or the real early
autochrome.
Yeah. So when you're looking at some of those very early color films that were the straight slide film, they were really optimized to be able to deliver as natural of a color onto those films as possible. And that's part of that coding process by removing some of that haze, some of that color fringing, some of those chromatic aberrations really gives you good opportunity to make sure you're getting the best print, the best negative and the best print for what you're working with.
Well, fantastic. And thank you so much for joining us again, Andrew. And we certainly hope to see you on one of our future episodes. That's it for us here in Rochester. Heading back into the studio. Okay. So, yeah.
That was a fun trip.
Great discussion.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, as I said, Rochester is a day trip. You can easily get started at like 6 o'clock in the morning from here.
I've done it.
You can be at the George Eastman House for when it's open, stay the day, and just head back home. Of course, you'll want to go into downtown Rochester, grab a bite at the Genesee Brew Pub. Fantastic view. Fantastic food and a fantastic view of the Kodak Tower across the falls.
Awesome.
Say, Donna, there's a bit of a road trip for us. Maybe we'll take our kids and have a bit of fun down there.
Yeah. Sounds good. There's even a great museum in downtown Rochester that is designed for kids. So cool. You can spend half the day at the Eastman House and the other half the day at the Kids Museum.
Maybe the start of the day at the Kids Museum to knock them out.
There you go. Yeah.
Hi everyone, John here, and yes, it's time for the Summer Toronto Film Shooters Meetup on Saturday, August the 13th. We'll be looking at some old rail and bridge infrastructure in the city. The plan is to meet at the park near the Bridgepoint Family Health Team. There's a park nearby. This is a tripod-friendly meet, so we won't be moving at a quick pace. Feel free to bring along your heavy equipment. And plenty of water. Official meetup time is 9, and we'll be moving out at 9:30. Now, after the official bridge portion of the event, for those who, came from out of town or are hanging around, we'll be continuing east into the beaches for the afternoon and evening with guide yours truly. And those sticking around on Sunday can join up with me for the famous Kensington Market and High Park. We'll be posting a link to the Facebook event in the show notes, but if you have trouble accessing it and you want to attend, send me an email, jgmeadows@gmail.com, and I'll provide you all the information. We hope to see you there.
So that about covers it for this episode. Signing out, I'm Alex Loke saying keep those shutters firing.
I'm Donna Bataxi and keep that film rolling.
I'm Mike Bataxi and make sure you've got your own red dot.
I'm John Meadows. If you wonder where the yellow went, it's right here.
We're not going there.
Well, the show does stream.
Oh,
boy.